A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book. A romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hello there and welcome to the best of A Taste of Ireland. I'm Ed Finn. Great to have you along this Sunday evening, the 21st of March. We have a great show lined up this evening. Later on, we'll be talking to Liam O'Mwainley about his connection to the Eurovision. We'll also be chatting to Dominic Kemp, who'll be explaining to us the secrets of the keto diet. But first up, it's Fiona Cunningham, Country Manager for Tourism Northern Ireland here in Ireland. And Fiona will be giving us some of her top tips and recommendations for visiting Northern Ireland. But first, she tells us about how her son raised funds for the homeless during lockdown.
That's right, Ed. My 9-year-old son, James, mad cycling fan. In fact, 3 children are mad cycling fans. You tick after their dad. James was very concerned and very worried about the homeless, actually. During lockdown and during COVID-19, he was concerned. He was looking after them. He was concerned if they were on the streets, you know, were they properly social distancing? And this just led to a whole stream of questions and going on. So finally, Keith and myself said, look, we're going to have to do something about this, because this guy is not going to give us peace until, you know, he wanted to do something for charity. He wanted to do a cycle. And we said, look, it's not safe to be going out on the road cycling, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously during lockdown, we were then restricted to the 5 kilometre, you know, distance. So Keith set up like a simulator connected to the computer. And he basically did a cycle over a 12-hour period of 256 kilometres. He did 6 hours one day, 6 hours the following day. And to be honest, I have to say I was very nervous about the whole thing, Ed. But he assured me that it was no problem. And I think his goal originally was to cycle maybe 200 kilometres from memory. But even when he reached the 256, he wanted to keep going. I had to pull him off the bike and go, no, you know, that's enough now.
How much did he raise?
So he raised almost €4,000, which was just, you know, fantastic for a little boy, you know. And I suppose it just caught the attention and the imagination of people who just saw how young he was and just wanted to do something for, you know, with people who were homeless and without a home. It's such a difficult time for everybody, really. So I think it was the kindness and the thoughtfulness of it that touched
that's,
people.
That's really, really nice. I mean, most kids would be playing with their computers and things like that. I'm very impressed. That's fabulous. Well done, James.
No, Minecraft hasn't entered our house yet, and hopefully it won't for some time. He's one of the very few, I believe, in his class that don't have Fortnite or Minecraft.
If anybody who hasn't been up north, what would you say would be your recommendations for a first timer?
Yeah, well, it really depends on your interest, depends on your age, depends, you know, what sort of thing, activities or pastimes that you're into. But, you know, there's a whole load of stuff to be done, you know, in Belfast, or if you wanted to travel further afield to Fermanagh. We have the new OM Dark Sky Observatory, which is opening up in County Tyrone now on the 17th, actually, of October. It's the first one in Northern Ireland. And
That is actually, I mean, I got to do that last year when I was doing some filming up there, and that is incredible. There's also a stone circle there, the Dava Skies.
Yes, the Dava Forest. I think that's quite a special place if that's something that you're into. You know, it's a really, like, as the name would suggest, it's a dark sky. It's one of the few places in Northern Ireland where you can actually really see the stars.
Yeah, we actually saw the Milky Way.
Yeah,
I mean, really clearly. Unbelievable.
And the opening is designed around, I think there's the full moon or new moon around that time. So, the conditions will be perfect at that time of year. Getting away from it all, you know, we've lots of walks and hikes and all the rest of it. But there's a plethora of things to do, Ed, across Northern Ireland, really depending on, you know, what you're interested in.
The other thing, Fiona, that has grown massively over the years is set jetting, where people visit places that they, you know, if they have a famous TV program like Game of Thrones, or of course The Fall with Jamie Dornan, like known for other movies, maybe like different ones. The Fall, of course, very strong, very dark, but amazing. Derry Girls, mm-hmm. Oh my God. I mean, mm-hmm. what an amazing series. That's something that is massive, isn't it, for tourism as well, the set jetting.
Huge, actually, Ed. I mean, Game of Thrones, I guess, is a bit like what Lord of the Rings did for New Zealand, Game of Thrones did for Northern Ireland. It brought people to Northern Ireland that would not have come otherwise or would never have been there before, to go and do some of the tours and experience that themselves and get up close with some of even the, you know, the extras that had been on the show themselves. And then, of course, we have the Linen Mill Studios in Banbridge, who we've gotten the green light for planning permission there now. So those studios really hope to attract over 600,000 people a year, and it'll be the only Game of Thrones studio tour actually in the world, which is really exciting for us. It'll be an interactive experience, and where visitors will actually come face to face with original set pieces, props and weapons used to create the worlds of Westeros and Easteros. I mean, you watched Game of Thrones yourself.
I made a program all about the film locations there, which was really amazing, you know. I mean, the way that they made it, and I mean, you can see why HBO, when they sent their scouts out, you can see. I remember being in Ballantyne in different places there and seeing the amazing scenes they created and the money they spent. I mean, each program, they spent a film budget on each TV program. It's phenomenal stuff.
It really is. And I mean, an average of about 350,000 people come every year to Northern Ireland purely because of Game of Thrones. And to put that in context, that's like one in every six leisure visitors are coming to Northern Ireland because of Game of Thrones. Spending an average of about 50 million, I think it is.
It's incredible how a TV programme, like film like that, and done properly, can
phenomenon.
Just create mm-hmm. such attractions. And people just, they have this, and I know, saying they have this amazing urge to participate. And of course, in Westeros and Castle Ward, you have all these experiences. You get dressed up in the Game of Thrones clothes. You have archery, you have your swords. You know, they don't have the dragons. I haven't seen any dragons up there, but flying around anyway. but it's really amazing. So you can do all that. So I remember going out with a guy called, remember Richard, I did Aquaholics, and you do this amazing thing from the sea in this beautiful boat and mm-hmm. Fair Head there and the cliffs where, of course, Jon Snow touched the dragon on the head. And
that's right.
Amazing stuff.
So those are unique things that you can only do in Northern Ireland, you know. And you said there about Derry Girls as well. And, of course, Jamie Dornan and The Fall, which was a huge phenomenon at the time. My sister actually has that bath, you know, the bath where he, like, you know, washed the ladies.
Yeah.
She has that in her back garden. I think she got it for a party and it's stayed there ever since.
Wow. Amazing. It's such a brilliant series. And there's a new one, of course. Brilliant to hear that there's a new one coming out soon as well, which is fantastic.
Right.
And Derry, of course, just touching, I mean, even there, I saw the Blue Book have a property up there now, Bishop's Gate, which is absolutely stunning. I mean, you know, in terms of that whole quality and, like, really, really beautiful, again, for food and the welcome, because I suppose it's quite far up in Derry, even, is, again, another, on top of the welcome you get. It's almost like a double. They're so friendly there.
Derry's a wonderful city. It really is. Again, steeped in history.
Yeah,
and
the town I loved so well.
You know, you can go and do the lovely walking tours around the city walls, and it's just a lovely city, a really friendly city, as you say, Ed. Like, lots to see and do. And of course, Derry celebrated the year. It was the City of Culture back in 2013, which we had a whole host of events to celebrate that year.
Yeah, and you had the Turner Prize there, I think, as well, and the Lumiere, where the whole city was lit up. And of course, that Peace Bridge, Fiona, is really fabulous, you know, that they built across the
That's right, yes. A lot of people would actually visit the city to go across that Peace Bridge itself. And we had the Round the World Clipper Yacht Race, which came also to Derry.
You can actually go by train from anywhere in Ireland, from Cork, if you want, to Belfast, and you can take the train right across. Now, for anyone who doesn't know, Michael Palin, did the Derry to Coleraine train trip, which hugs the coastline.
And that's a stunning, you know, if you've got a beautiful sunny day and you sit at the right side of the tree, and obviously that is actually, I would recommend that to anybody. It's just stunning.
Absolutely. It's stunning. And that's one thing I think that a lot of people, they must do if they do, you know, if you do get time, allow yourself time to experience that. And, you know, because, as I said, it is, they're different different experiences in all the different places. So that would be a really good one to do. It has been a phenomenal 10 years for you in terms of growth. I mean, well done on the numbers, because it's just incredible, the transformation. And I suppose the way that Northern Ireland has embraced the peace, the way it is for so safe now, and that the changes have been phenomenal. But just the growth in tourism, and I mean, Fiona, you only have now, I suppose, with even just domestic, it's incredible when people can't really travel.
True, Ed. I mean, it's a great opportunity now for us as the National Tourist Board in Northern Ireland to really sell our wares to the Republic of Ireland and to open up and just to showcase some of those hidden gems that we have. You know, obviously we have the Giant's Cause, we've Titanic Belfast, we've wonderful museums and all the rest of it, but there's all those little hidden gems and little stories and little experiences all through Northern Ireland that, you know, we're trying to showcase now.
But Fiona, well done on a great 10 years. You studied law and you ended up working for Tourism Northern Ireland. It's a great progression. I think they were very lucky. Very lucky you didn't decide to become Ally McBeal.
They just need to treble my salary and then, you know, I'll be up there with the lawyers.
Everybody knows that I love you. Everybody knows that I need you.
Welcome back to the Best of a Taste of Ireland. Next on the show this evening, one of Ireland's leading food entrepreneurs and author, Dominie Kemp. And she explains to us all about the keto or the ketogenic diet.
Yeah, so I think, it goes back to your point. You know, people think fat equals fat. And, you know, it's not as simple as that. But the ketogenic diet actually was originally established for epilepsy. And I guess then really it started to be looked at in terms of things like weight loss and type 2 diabetes, because again, what it does is it throws your body from burning carbohydrates, which is the normal fuel, as it were, that the body uses, into burning fat. So you are restricting the amount of carbohydrates. Your body switches, so almost from a diesel engine to a petrol engine, your body switches and starts burning fat. Now, one of the common mistakes with the ketogenic diet or thoughts around it, and again, I have to really preface, it's not suitable for everyone. There are definitely some, people have impaired liver function, etc. It's not a diet for them. So it is quite powerful metabolic therapy, and they, you know, people should get the go ahead before they start it. But one of the, I suppose, misconceptions is that, you know, you're eating steak for breakfast, you know, a bit like the Atkins, that you're eating unlimited amounts of fat and so on. That's not the way forward. So even though you have a classic one for epilepsy, when you're looking at it for weight loss or type 2 diabetes, for which it's really well established now in terms of its safety record and success, you know, there are some fruits, there's plenty of green vegetables. You know, again, it's about having a really nutrient-dense ketogenic diet or low carb diet if you want something a little bit more moderate, and that's what's really important. The idea also that you can have unlimited amounts of fat is a misconception. You know, even though you're increasing your fat, if you're putting butter into your coffee and everything, you're gonna have problems.
That was one thing that I found, it was big in America. There's a whole coffee, cafes have come up, built up around this. Yeah, the bulletproof. Yeah. That seems to be, I mean, quite strange for us to think that you put a spoon of butter into your coffee.
Yeah, and it's a bit revolting, if I'm honest, you know. Yeah, like, you know, and the thing is, it's interesting. A study just came out, and again, it's part of the nutrition wars, and it was looking at intermittent fasting, you know, which is something I really enjoy doing. I love fasting. I've last couple of years, I've done a 10-day fast. And so on. It's really great as a kind of reset for health. But, you know, intermittent fasting, I really like doing, and sort of just eat one meal in the evening time. I might have a little cream in my coffee in the morning and that's it. And that'll keep me going. A lot of herbal teas and maybe the little bit of a broth later on at lunchtime. But really, the idea is that your body does, you know, it's this metabolic flexibility, which is kind of what you're after. But a study came out and it was looking at intermittent fasting, and it was sort of saying, oh, well, actually, people who were fasting didn't lose more weight than the other group that were able to eat kind of what they wanted. But it's missing the point. When you're intermittent fasting, you're usually missing one or two meals. And I guess, again, it's a study that comes out, people snatch the headlines, and, you know, it's like those things, coffee causes cancer, and then 2 weeks later, coffee cures, you know, it's like...
Yeah, and I think a lot of the time as well, I've tried... I like that intermittent fasting, because I feel it's, you know, the way our bodies are like engines and we're constantly,
eat. And if you're constantly stoking up the engine, I just personally feel it's wear and tear, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's interesting. Again, you have to look at where some of this these messages come from in terms of these sort of doctrines, as it were. And, you know, you can sometimes trace them back to food companies that sell breakfast bars and cereals. Suits them to be telling you to eat little and often and to constantly snack and graze. Well, why do we need to constantly snack and graze? You know, our ancestors didn't do it. And certainly we live in a food environment that is, you know, people say obesogenic, that is, it's far too plentiful. We can access food 24 hours a day if we want. And really not giving your system a break is, you know, you can understand how you're just, you never give your system a chance to reset. So this idea of sort of cells being able to replenish and to die off and to do that bit of housekeeping, you know, having good periods where you're not always stuffing your face with snacks, that's a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've never seen a fat lion or a gazelle either. I suppose nature does it really well, doesn't it?
Really well. And again,
and the processed foods, of course.
That's exactly it. And I think that, you know, when you look at, it's a really good study, and it showed even women who were able to sort of fast for a 13-hour period, breast cancer patients, they had, again, better outcomes. And you kind of think, oh, 13 hours. But actually, that's maybe eating at 6 or 7 p.m. and not eating again maybe until 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. Very doable, very doable. And when you look at the significant risks and the benefits achieved, again, this is simple things, a simple thing that someone could do to improve their overall health.
The dish I cooked there, the chicken with lemon and green olives, was delicious. I mean, a lot of people might think that some of the stuff, you know, doesn't taste good. I mean, the flavour was amazing. I did the turmeric and I did a lot of the stuff, which is
gorgeous.
Really, really healthy. And it was, and it's really filling. And of course, touching on Mediterranean as well with olives and the herbs, as you said, for anyone, Dominie, that would like to start off doing it, I mean, what advice be to them?
Yeah, so I say definitely start off the first half of the book, and or start any book that's a sort of low carb book, because again, it's just giving you different ideas of what to eat for breakfast and lunch when your go to might be some toast or something like that. So really, that's the idea, sort of a breakfast that might be a bit more kind of fruit driven or even vegetable driven. Eggs as well, you know, they had such a bad rap for years. Eggs are brilliant food to have, you know, a frittata in the morning or some scrambled eggs with a handful of spinach and some tomatoes. Amazing breakfast, you know, a really good vegetable soup for lunch. And then dinner might be more vegetables and a little bit of good quality protein and again, healthy fats. So that's the kind of thing that you eat. Certainly for low carb, I do have, you know, some pulses, some legumes and so on. Mainly because I really like them and there are some health benefits. I'm not fully keto. I'd find it too difficult, but certainly low carb really, really works. And again, it's knowing those danger spots. So most people, evening time, stomach's hungry, you know, tired and thingy. There's some really great recipes for like low carb crackers and breads, things that you want to put fat on. So maybe a little bit of cheese or butter with them, but they just stop you from reaching for those crisps or something else that's quick and fast and it's going to, you know, solve that salty hunger that you often can have in the evening time.
That is the thing. You're absolutely right on that. And how long does it take, or how long did it take you to break that carb cycle or that, you know, addiction?
Yeah, it was certainly a while. And it's really understanding what happens to you when you eat carbs and sort of the impact that it does. You know, I am a bit of a nerd, so I'd put a continuous glucose monitor on to really track what was going on. And again, it's so interesting to see what different foods and even a bad night's sleep, what that can do to your glucose level. It's also, you know, people going through keto, like if they do transfer to a ketogenic diet, you know, they can feel grim for a couple of days. They can go through what's known as the keto flu. But again, you know, it's not for everyone. And that's the thing. You often hear people plunging straight into something and it doesn't suit them and they make loads of mistakes and it all goes kind of haywire. It is something you have to kind of invest some time in education and get the all clear from a doctor before you start it. But certainly low carb is a very safe and healthy way to eat. And certainly doing that is a great place to start and see how you feel. You know, some people feel brilliant on a vegan diet. Some people feel brilliant on it is absolutely all dependent on the individual.
What recipe would you give people for uplifting your mental health and making you feel a little bit a natural high, Dominie? about that? A natural high. And I'm not talking about the Chianti, you know.
No, grapes. I'll put grapes in there somewhere. I think actually breakfast tends to be a real struggle. And actually, there are two recipes in Patricia's section of the book, which I really love. One is there's a keto granola bar, which is just brilliant because you can have it in the freezer, which is really good in terms of it lasts forever. But it's just, I find if I'm on the go, I can usually be intermittent fasting and I can think, if I'm sitting at home, I'm usually writing about foods, I'm either writing up menus or something. And I find it very hard if I'm sitting at home all day not to think, wonder what I could eat downstairs.
Yeah. Like Nigella sneaking down for the chocolate cake exactly. In the middle of the night.
Much less glamorous, but yeah, something like that. So these are actually a great one because a tiny little lump of them is a brilliant thing to have with a cup of tea. But there's also a keto smoothie in there with coconut milk and loads of berries. And again, it's a really great thing. And kids really love it as well. I'll tell you, they are stuffed going to school on it. It's got some protein in it and everything. A really great way to start the day.
Well, Domini, that brings us along to your choice of music this evening. And this is something I love to do, by the way, daydreaming Aretha Franklin.
Yeah, she's just so incredible. And again, beautiful album, Young, Gifted and Black. This is just one of the tracks on it. And it's just stunning. She just, oh, again, I could listen to her forever.
Welcome back to the Best of a Taste of Ireland. I hope you're enjoying the show this evening. Our final guest is singer, songwriter and frontman with the Hothouse Flowers, Liam O'Mwanley. And Liam tells us all about his connection to the Eurovision.
We were the Riverdance of that time, which was maybe 3 years before the Riverdance happened. And it was, it was interesting. I'd love to know what was going on in people's heads that moment when Declan Lowney came into the factory where we were rehearsing, and our management had offices there, and we had this meeting, and Declan was quite kind of almost embarrassed in asking us, would we be interested in being this? And it would be a move. We'd be filmed in these towns all over Europe and busking, and I thought, jeepers, that's on a plate. We didn't think twice about it. Planxty had done it maybe 3 years before that with Bill Whelan. They did a thing called Time Dance. And very beautiful, some really, really beautiful music in that piece. And I remember I was 15 when that happened, I think. And in school at Cullosh Seoghan, where I went to school, we were all listening to what was going on in the traditional side of things. And the school was great. We had this big, assembly hall where we had lunch. And there was a piano, and there was a record player on top of the piano. And so often the older kids would have records fresh off the press. And so the Monday after, the Tuesday after the Eurovision happened, where Donal Lunny and Planxty and Andy Irvine and Christy was there and Bill had this time dance. The lads were learning it already. There was kind of like it was good. It was finding its way into the bones of the people in our place. And there was very little hesitation about being involved in the interval act. And then also, we weren't being asked to write a song for the Eurovision. So there was that also. And the song had already been written.
I think that video was
it captured
unique
us.
And it was brilliant. It did really. It was fabulous.
It captured these kids who were surfing something bigger than themselves. And it really captured that, and it captured the borders. And I actually, maybe 1993. So that was 1988, I think it was. In 1993, I did an interview with a guy, and it was the first time I got grilled about it. And, it was like, and it was a fair, like, I didn't think twice about the actual political side of it, that this European Union flag was flying. To me, it was all love and peace and hugs.
Yeah, yeah, and I think for a lot of us, I think the Irish, we kind of have,
we didn't
have
even
that
think
idea about Europe as well. Yeah. It gives us a few bob, and it gives us, you know, it gives us a sense of belonging to something sort of exciting or a bit exotic, maybe.
And it's worth discussing the fact that Europe is the cause of an awful lot of pain and an awful lot of the end of worlds for communities and smaller countries. It has been the root of an awful lot of blood and death. And I think that's another part of the discussions that have to be had now, you know. And we're still kind of on the back of those spoils, where the mining and the diamonds and whatever it is that's needed to fuel Europe or America, the sort of the Eurocentric world, you know, and it could be fruit or banana, whatever it is. Mm. You know, it's on the backs of people, and we have to wake up to that.
Your travels are quite, I mean, amazing. You've been all over the world. Now, when you were 18, you did a little bit of a solo. You went off to London. You took off. That was your first.
That was my first step away, and I was a very low kid at that age. I was very low. I was a maybe traumatized by school, by just, there was a kid, there was a sense of, not, I knew I was a musician, but I had no idea how this was going to happen. And it was a mountain I was afraid to even look at. So I went to London and I had nothing. I never got anything. I ended up staying in a squat in Brixton for 2 months, which was fascinating and amazing to see the organization of the time. And that you could legally live in a place and make it work. And people really knew how to make those places work. And it was great to be in that. But my energy levels were so low. I was just about taking over. And actually, I was living in a house where there was the first half of that period. There was a guy, you know, from Sligo selling heroin, and his name was Liam as well. So God help anyone who came looking for me, because
that's not the right Liam.
It was usually the other fella they were looking for. But you know, so, and but for the grace of God, my curiosity, I was educated enough to know that really wasn't a place to go. You know, I was curious about a lot of the other drugs, but the heroin I knew, no, there's probably no coming back from that one. Not that I know of, but just saying, you know, I'm possibly kind of lucky I did come back. And I didn't have any plans to come back. I'd kind of gone, okay, I'm gone now. I've gone, I'm here. And slowly but surely, I might have started busking. I think I was starting to work up some kind of idea that I'd do something. But then I got word from an ex-girlfriend of mine who lived on Eglinton Road, who's since passed away, a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful woman that I would just love to pay tribute to. Fiona Scott was her name. I used to call her, I didn't call my parents, because that was for, it was my dad, myself, father and sons, you know, it's that kind of thing. But I didn't call him, but I called Fiona, and she said, you did okay and you're leaving, you've been accepted into Trinity, your folks want you to come home, they're going to send you enough money to come home. I went, okay. But I had just given myself a mohawk, or my Podge Bean, who I was sharing the squat with, had just given me a mohawk. I was going, oh, can you smooth this down a little bit?
Brilliant. So that was amazing. So you started college with the mohawk then?
Well, it was subtle enough. Like, it just looked like a short back and sides by the time I got home. And it was so good to come home, because you really realise the network of friendship and blood and all this that's in your own country. And to come home to that, after being in this big city, which is a maze, you know, it's a beautiful maze when you have the money for to pay what you need, or you know how to maneuver through it. But I didn't. And to come back home to the buoyancy of friendship and support. And also then suddenly things started happening with music. And I also saw a band in London, 9 out of 10 Cats they were called, and they were brilliant. I saw them in Dublin. They were kind of black rock, Dunleary bunch of guys. Really energetic. The singer used to dance for the whole gig. Just danced, you know. You didn't see that too often. And the great, great charisma. And I thought, these guys are going to really be great. And They were one of the addresses that I had, and I contacted them, and they wanted me to play fiddle. They thought I played fiddle because I spoke Irish. But I did a gig with them, and I played a bit of synth, and I played a cowbell. But they were living in a house in London with a manager, and they were just disappearing into London. They were just disappearing into the woodwork, into the frame, and they all did different things. The band never ended up, never happened. And I saw that, and I recognised that. And I stayed with another band called Kiss Dare, who were absolutely brilliant. They were from Derry. And they kind of kept going. But again, I just got this sense, you've got to be in your own place to put down your roots and to let yourself bear fruit and then go. And I really learned that subconsciously and maybe consciously. And so when I came back, I knew if you do something here, you've got your family, you've got your friends, you've got your circles, different circles of friends, whether it's college, school, blah, blah, blah. And they'll all come to the gig. And if you're no good, they won't come again. But if you're good, they might come again. And that's what happened with us. And our first gig was diabolical, but it was interesting. And we had Maria Doyle was singing with us at that stage, yeah. The first. And it was in the Magic Carpet in Cornell's Court. And, you know, so it was about 70 people there. And they came back the next week and we were just that little better. And then the third week, we hit it. We hit the wave of what we needed. And I got that feeling, and it was one of the most beautiful feelings to walk along Moorhampton Road back to the couch that I was staying on, you know, having done that.
It must have been incredible to take your unique sound and your music then to, you know, huge audiences.
Yeah, well, I suppose the biggest gig we did, and I listened to it and I go, my God, it was in excess. We're playing Wembley Stadium and we were part of the support. And the place was full when we went on and played, and the crowd was with us. That whole stadium and the crowd was with us. And it was broadcast on Radio 1. My parents heard it. They were driving from Kerry to Dublin or something. And there is it's out. It's on YouTube, actually. The engineer who recorded it for the BBC has been putting out all those gigs recently. So you can hear it. You can't see it, but you can hear it. And, you know, if you like an Irish band, you like listening to a band doing well abroad, that's an example. That's where, holy shit, we did that. We did
brilliant.
That, you know. And yeah. It's kind of like, I have to keep listening to it. We did shake that place. And I even remember the sound check, and I sang a Shando song. And I just got filling that space with that old, old language just to resonate, you know, and it felt so great to do that.
Your next choice of music for this evening, Liam.
Yeah, well, I mentioned Shando's, and I only heard this actually recently, and I've been listening to it ever since. It's Diane Cannon and Lillis O'Leary. He was one of the finest scholars of Shando singing. He is a phenomenal national treasure with his knowledge of the Shandos. And so this is a song where it's called An Dreinean Dhomhain.
Mahi tu chi e arai.